From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We're in New York, and as always, it's good to have friends to the show, and no better friend to the show than our old friend Peter Becker of Criterion Collection. Good to have you back here.
Nice to be here.
So much to catch up on. It's been a while since you've been here. And first and foremost, why don't we start with Filmstruck?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's been the biggest new thing we've done. We launched this streaming service with Turner Classic Movies, and the idea was really to create a home base for people who care about movies primarily. You know, there really wasn't a service out there focused on movies, and all of the things that are being selected for us are being selected for us sort of algorithmically based on what we've watched in the past. So there really wasn't a very good engine of discovery kind of or archive of just great movies that you could rove through. And that was the goal, was to make a place that was really, as Filmstruck likes to say, by film lovers, for film lovers. And, you know, it's been a really exciting year. We've treated it kind of as an experimental year. We've tried a whole bunch of different things, and we've settled down on what we think is really the core of the programming. And it's really starting to look like the service we want now.
Because one of the things when I heard about this, I thought, you know, now that basically video stores are gone, so the idea of going and rifling through and just looking, seeing something on a shelf, I'll try this out because it looks interesting and the copy on the box makes it look like something I want to see. That idea of just discovering something that you didn't anticipate has almost disappeared from the way we consume film nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was a great pleasure for those of us who would go to the old Kim's Video or whatever and just scan the shelves. And often the best part was seeing something where you didn't expect it, or seeing something, you know, in a new way, or discovering something you hadn't seen before just because of the way that it was set to browse. And having a great cinematheque in your town, which, you know, in New York we're fortunate to have quite a few well-programmed theaters, but having good cinematheque in your town is another way to discover. And I think for us it's been important to kind of cover the whole life of a film. So we've been doing theatrical releases of new and classic films. We've been making special edition DVDs and Blu-rays, and now we have this streaming service where we can kind of really nimbly program in a way that we never could in either of those other media. So it's really expanded the way that we approach our audience, and I think it's getting exciting. I mean, the core to Filmstruck is the main Filmstruck platform, which is largely thematically organized the way that, you know, classic cinematheque retrospectives might be, like director retrospectives or a country passport or a focus on a certain kind of issue or a sub-theme in film. And when we program the Criterion Channel, which is a part of Filmstruck, and it's the it's sort of the premium tier of Filmstruck, but both services together are $99 a year, and they're meant to work together. So on our side, we've stayed away from that kind of thematic programming and that kind of general sorting into categories and focused more on people's engagement with film. So we have a series called Adventures in Movie Going, which is basically a guest programmer series. And underlying that series is the idea that we're all equal as moviegoers, that you don't have to be a filmmaker or a film critic to have real opinions and a real passion for cinema. So we've had novelists like Jhumpa Lahiri and Jonathan Lethem. We've had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who turns out to be an unbelievably passionate exponent for samurai films. We've had also filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro or Roger Corman. And they sit down with us and talk about their life as a moviegoer, and we get to know a little bit about them as they watch movies, and then they choose some movies for us and introduce them. And that's turned into one of the sort of key flagship elements of the Criterion Channel. There's another series we're really excited about called Meet the Filmmakers, where we send a filmmaker out to have an encounter with another filmmaker. The resulting documentary is not a biography, and it's not a filmography, it's not a stately march through a career with clips. It's the feeling of just encountering somebody, and it was inspired by a series that they've made in France for a long time called Cinéaste de Notre Temps, which you'll also find streaming on the Criterion Channel.
Oh my goodness.
Quite a few episodes of that. We're about to put up the first ever on-camera interview with Robert Bresson, which is great.
Wow.
There's a fabulous piece about John Cassavetes that is while he was making and editing Faces, which was a 3-year process. So those are some that we're pretty excited about. And, you know, in our guest curator department, I think part of the idea is to allow filmmakers to be filmmakers in Meet the Filmmakers and allow filmmakers to be moviegoers in Adventures in Movie Going. So that's part of the kind of the way that we break those down. Then there's another series that we're super excited about that happens monthly. I have this idea that everybody wants to go to film school like 10 minutes a month. Right? And so we asked the authors of Film Art, which is like the Film 101 textbook, David Bordwell, Kristen Thompson, and Jeff Smith, to sort of tag team once a month, giving a 10-minute micro class on a particular aspect of film form, using one film usually to demonstrate it. And we show that little piece and we show that film. And the idea is that you learn skills about how to watch movies, how to decode movies, how to think about movies in a new way. But you learn it in light of one film, and then you can go apply it to all the other films you watch. And so that's kind of been one of our responses to, like, what can we do with a streaming service, you know, other than show posters and let people click on them and have a computer decide what you might like.
Well, what it's about, as much as what Criterion is about, it's still the excitement of film consumption, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's the whole thing. You know, we've always been a company that's guided by a mission, not a medium, right? We never thought of ourselves as a Laserdisc company. We never thought of ourselves as a DVD company or a home video distributor. And maybe that's because we were also caring for films in theaters and we were also, you know, putting films on television. But I think it was mostly because what we really thought was that the medium is the mechanism that allows us to approach the world. And our job is to make the best use of the medium. And so in the beginning, that meant that if you did a commentary track, it had to be a mono film because we only had left and right channels. And you just put the commentary on the right channel and put the movie on the left channel. But you couldn't do a commentary on a stereo film, you know. And then we got digital tracks and suddenly we could have commentaries on everything. And then we got, DVD image quality was pretty revelatory when it happened. And then Blu-ray was even better. And the great thing about streaming is that for the first time in 30 years, on the Criterion Channel, we're able to rove. You know, we've been approaching everything one film at a time and really just doing our best for that film. Really, really focused work. And for the first time now, we don't have to go one film at a time. We can think across filmographies and across generic boundaries and across national boundaries. And we can find threads that might be actual threads in film history and film culture, or they might be threads in one person's passion for cinema. One of my favorite adventures in movie going, which is, I think, one of the most recent, I think it may even still be up, is the conversation that I had with Barry Jenkins. And what's so interesting about that conversation for me is that his film education begins after he decides he wants to become a filmmaker. You know, most of the time we assume filmmakers want to be filmmakers because they love film. And for Barry, it was really this this question of, well, you know, growing up, he went to the movies, but the movies was, you know, three buses away for him. And it was not like an easy outing. So they went out for like, you know, it was kind of a special occasion. And it wasn't really a part of their daily life. And he went to college and he was studying English and he was going to be an English teacher, he thought. And he was in a creative writing class and he had written a story, and a teacher, we all have to bow to the teachers who have changed us. A teacher said to him, "You're a very visual storyteller." And it stuck with him. And every Friday, he and his friends used to go to lunch in the stadium, because the stadium was where they made this special lunch for the football players, big football school.
You say he went to school in Florida.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. This was at FSU. And he would go to this lunch in the stadium and with his friends, because it was the best lunch on campus, and they were allowed to go on Fridays. And every Friday, he realized he had been walking past this door that was the film school, because the film school was in the stadium. And one day he just said, "I guess I'm going to go in there and check it out." You know, this idea that he was a visual storyteller had come to him, and he thought, go check it out. And he ended up taking on a whole second major, spent a year there, felt maybe this wasn't for him, but for a really interesting reason. And this is all stuff that he's talking about on the channel as a preface to the films that he wants to show. But, you know, he had to ask himself. He said, I took a year off of school to prove to myself or to ask myself this question. Am I not good at this because I grew up poor and black? Because all these middle-class white kids who are in this program seem to be better at this than I am. They have a more natural sense of it than I do. And he took a year off. And he said he just watched everything he could watch. He did camera experiments. He did all kinds of stuff. And came back and obviously, you know, discover that he's a filmmaker. But I just thought that was such an interesting experience of being a moviegoer, that suddenly his approach to moviegoing was really about educating himself about everything you could do with a camera, trying to surprise himself with all the things you could do with film form, and really coming out really one of the filmmakers who I think most successfully carries a really rich experimental approach toward the act of making making films into storytelling that's obviously, you know, from a perspective and a voice that we haven't heard nearly enough of, but so gorgeously enacted on screen. I mean, it's clearly, whoever that creative writing teacher was, hats off for you saying you're a visual storyteller.
My guest, who's a pretty good storyteller in his own right, is Peter Baker. It's good to have him back here, the Criterion Collection. We're talking about, well, so much stuff, but there's a, certainly a film circuit in the Criterion Channel. But this gets me back to when we first met at Telluride. I was always struck by your fascination with sort of the emotional undercurrents of how these films get made. And that's still what really, for me, powers the Criterion Collection.
Sure, people are making these things. I think that's something we're pretty conscious of. I mean, I think one of the things that has saved us from calcifying or drying up too much is this feeling that we're not actually experts in anything except doing what we do. And nobody else really knows what we do as well as we do. So at that, we can actually say day to day, we're good at that. So then we say, well, what does it mean to do what we do with this film or with this filmmaker or with this body of work? And a lot of the time that does have to do with thinking about the person behind it. You know, a lot of filmmakers become such icons that we can't really imagine that there was a maker there, you know. And the thing about film art also is that this very idea that there was a maker is by itself kind of suspect, because film is normally such a collaborative art, right? And so a lot of the time it means turning over the way that we look at movies.
But again, this for me goes back to our first conversation. It was always to me, and you're proving it here still, this idea there are people behind all these things, and there are stories that these people have to tell. And the stories are great on their own in isolation, but they also give the film much more resonance once you have an idea of these stories, and that there's more than one, if you pardon the expression, auteur to every film.
Sure. And it's not just the stories. I mean, the stories are fun, but they're not always keys to the film. You know what I mean? They're fun to know, and often, but you know, it's a combination of stories and techniques and skills, and even often people who have the boldness to do things the way that they're not supposed to do them. You know, this isn't supposed to be done that way. And you know, a lot of the films that are most lastingly important, when you look at them, you think, gosh, that was a crazy thing to do. I was showing there's a group every year we have a group of kids come in from the Ghetto Film School when they're starting out their program, and they're about to make a 6-minute short film with no dialogue. And we show them usually two films. We show them M and Do the Right Thing. And we're really primarily focused on the openings of both of those two films. And the opening of M is this incredible 12-minute sequence that manages to tell essentially wordlessly. We do hear a mother yelling the name of her daughter. She yells, Elsie, Elsie, out the window. But we really see this horrible story about a girl abducted and killed by a serial killer. And the film is a serial killer film. But we see nothing. And it's all done with cinematic techniques and all this stuff. And I've thought about this scene a lot, you know, when she's shouting this name out the window and he cuts to these shots of empty staircases and attics with sheets drying and just the emptiest spaces you can imagine, because that daughter is not there. And I love this sequence. But as I was watching it again recently, I started thinking about the fact that all through this film, there are sequences where it's an early sound film and he just wipes the whole soundtrack. Like, there's no ambient noise, there's no footsteps, there's no nothing. And then when a siren comes in or a bell goes off, you jump out of your seat. That was a 1930 film, and, you know, the degree of kind of experimentation that's going on there has as much to do with people just asking the question, what can I do? Do I have to do it the way it's always been done? And often those are the most exciting films to go, you know, poke around in.
We're talking about the stories behind the stories with the people who are excited by film. And one of those people who's excited by film is my guest, Peter Baker. We're going to take a break. We're talking about, of course, Film Story Criterion Collection. There's a lot more to come. Stay with us. It's The Treatment. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm excited, as always, to have our old friend Peter Baker, who's been too long since he's been here. We're talking about, of course, what he does, which is the Criterion Collection. And you're talking about people doing things and breaking the mold. I know you guys recently just did a restoration of a film that really broke the mold and is celebrating its 50th anniversary next year, and that's Night of the Living Dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that was a very sad moment for us because George Romero didn't actually live to see that come back out in theaters, but he did see this restoration at MoMA. And yeah, I mean, that film is one that we've wanted to work on for a long time, and there have been a number of different editions of it. And
because if you say it's unfortunately a film to public domain.
Well, yeah, it was a film that wasn't protected properly when it was made, so it's been very easy for people to steal and exploit it. But this new restoration does, you know, re-protect the film. This restoration is protected, which is great. And the chance to work on that film and to see it as more than just a horror film, but as really a groundbreaking film in lots of different ways about politics and race, and to see the cinematic techniques that Romero had steeped himself in watching Bergman films used on a zombie movie, or just the very idea that this is the movie that created the idea of the zombie. You know, there's a really nice little piece that, again, you can watch on Filmstruck, or that you could see, I think, on the Night of the Living Dead disc when it comes out, is a piece about Guillermo del Toro sort of talking about the contribution of Romero, and specifically in one section, you know, this idea of that the monster movie that traditionally happens off in some gothic landscape in some remote time with a castle on a mountain, some foreign place, that, you know, part of what Romero's incredible contribution is to move this into a recognizable landscape and to move this into just a normal, you know, it's a, you know, it's Pittsburgh. And it was made on a shoestring by a group of people who were coming together, never having made a feature film before.
Including an actor replacing the lead who just never materialized.
Yeah. And a great performance at that too. So the film, I think, is ripe for rediscovery. I think it is, you know, really interesting to talk about. And, you know, this idea, like, you know, here we are we've just come through what might have been the second commercial golden age of zombies, The Walking Dead. And you know, that idea of the zombie kind of being a flesh-eating undead creature is a complete creation of that film. You know, before that, a zombie was a purgatorial voodoo figure.
Absolutely.
You know, more like a ghost than this kind of weak, flesh-eating monster.
But that's the thing, too, that so much of these films are about the filmmakers who like to work. You know, mm-hmm. You say that, and there's this sort of need, there's this hunger to get these things out, and they're going to keep working. But there is, in hearing you talk about this, the same excitement that you have about this is the thing that year after year keeps people going back to the Criterion Collection. Again, I'll say what I said before when I met you. You just get this look in your eye, and I'm happy I'm here to see you do it, and I'm sorry the listeners can't, but you just start to relate what got you interested in the first place. And this is about your passion in discovering these things as much as it is anything else.
Yeah, I mean, every release has a story. You know, one of the biggest stories that we got to tell this year, and it really surprised a lot of people, and I think there are still a bunch of people who don't quite know what to make of it. Like, why did we do this? We released a huge box set at the end of this year called 100 Years of Olympic Films. And, you know, it's not what people expected from us, but it's really one of the most important.
Why do you say that? Because I feel like what Criterion does is it's not about following anybody's expectation. I mean, certainly we look to see what films, major films by major artists, but also the Criterion's had a history of doing things not dissimilar to this.
Sure. We've always kind of tried to emphasize the elasticity of the mission, that we can push at the boundaries of what people think we're supposed to be able to do, that's part of what makes it possible for us to take chances and be a little bit fresh about things. But I think, you know, when people heard 100 Years of Olympic Films, they were picturing, you know, just television coverage. And what they don't realize is that, you know, every Olympics, with the exception, it seems, of 1932 in America, which is interesting, has had a designated filmmaker associated with it. And these are not just, you know, the camera crew that the television station hired. There's a person, as, you know, we've been talking about, there's a person who's making this film. And that person might be Konichikawa making the 1964 Tokyo Olympiad, which is just one of the most stunning pieces of cinema, and a film that we had released separately, you know, on Laserdisc and on DVD, and, you know, we're dying to bring back in print anyway.
Is it out of print now for you guys? You don't have it?
Well, it's part of the Olympic set for now. I mean, I'm pretty sure that at some point that will get broken out. But right now, the Olympic set, the importance of the Olympic set is the sweep of it. I mean, if you think about it, there are very few global rituals that are so recognizable around the world that have happened so continuously for such a long period of time and been documented on film, right? Very hard to think of something that has brought people together from all over the planet on a regular basis and has been documented from beginning to end. So think about the Olympics, you know, as cinema people. It's an opportunity not just to look at some of the greatest achievements of human beings, but also of the development of film form and of what documentaries are and how filmmakers' voices work. So, you know, in 1894, when they have the first conference to think up the Olympics, right, we are 1 year from the time the Lumiere brothers will show the first film in a theater. And 1 year later, the first Olympics will happen in 1896. And by 1912, film and the Olympics were happening side by side. And in the beginning, those documents were newsreel-like in a sense. The 1912 coverage is beautiful to watch and exhaustive and lovely. And you get a sense of, you know, of culture and sport, but it's not exactly cinematic. You can feel that its purpose really is still to document something. But it's not very long before in the 20s, even in the silent period, we start to see the real birth of film style emerging in these films and the ways that they're trying to tell these stories. And the sameness of the Olympics, right? We know what it is. There's a torch lighting and there's a procession and there, you know, an opening ceremony and there's a marathon and there's a succession of awards and there's a closing ceremony. We know what the Olympics looks like. So as a filmmaker, you're challenged to see that fresh every time. And these are filmmakers that include Milos Forman and Claude Lelouch and, you know, people that we go to see their fiction films. Carlos Saura's marathon film is really an extraordinary piece of work and as cinema and a very, very interesting approach to the Olympics as sport. So, you know, that's idea of like watching film form emerge and watching all of these different voices struggling with this very formal event is one pleasure of the box. But another way to look at it is also that this is history, that this is the 20th century, and we can see the tides of, you know, of nationalism and globalism. You can sense that the technology is pushing what we're able to see. And what's interesting is that the technology brings us closer and closer to the action. But the filmmakers want to get closer and closer to the athletes. So, you know, film form really peaks in some ways with, I mean, another hugely important and very, you know, very controversial film because of its filmmaker, Olympia by Leni Riefenstahl, but which also contains one of the most poignant and inspiring moments in sports history, which is Jesse Owens' win in Berlin. So, you know, there's these moments where we're really seeing things happening on the world stage. But Riefenstahl's film is probably the height of film form in the Olympic set. And
just
maybe,
the diving sequence alone.
Exactly. I mean, it is so highly aestheticized, almost terrifyingly so at moments. And, you know, knowing what that idea of aesthetics can become or did become, you know. But more importantly, as we get closer and closer to the athletes, and there's no place the camera can't go underwater, there's no speed the camera can't stop, more and more, the filmmakers themselves come toward the athletes. And I really credit Konichikawa for this moment. There's the famous moment in Tokyo Olympiad where he takes an interest in the lone runner from Chad. And this idea just that a filmmaker, yes, what a filmmaker might be interested in about the Olympics is a person alone and far from home. And then you talk about the stories behind the stories. That athlete is interviewed on camera. And it's a scene where I think he's under, you know, there's bright lights around and he seems a little disoriented and he's speaking his native form of, I think it's Chadian Arabic. And this was hard enough for us to decipher that we didn't have a subtitling house that could translate Chadian Arabic. So we tracked down a Chadian Arabic person because it had never been translated in any previous version. And it turns out that actually they had asked him to speak Chadian Arabic, and that was what's in the film, but he actually spoke French. So, you know, on the one hand, it's one of the great moments of cinema because it's so good and it so works. And on the other hand,
we get from it anyway.
It's pure filmmaking. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that I love to discover. We love to discover. And, you know, it was a monumental work. It was 53 films on, you know, 30-odd Blu-rays and a huge book that's really beautifully designed and illustrated, and the International Olympic Committee was incredibly supportive with their archives, and it was a project that was really, really a dream to do.
How long did it take this to get to completion?
Well, not nearly long enough. I mean, that was part of it, was that we've been waiting to work on these films for, I mean, I guess our first conversations with the people working at the IOC side were working with the IOC were more than 10 years ago. It must have been about 2004 we first got involved in this thing. But the restorations were only finished, I would say, really finished, all of them, at the beginning of this year, maybe. And we really, really pulled this thing together. It was a backbreaking amount of work for a lot of people. I mean, it was a lot to digest. And the author of the book, Peter Cowie, is a longtime Criterion contributor. He recorded one of the very first commentary tracks on Seventh Seal, and which is still a great commentary. And Peter happens to be, Peter happens to be a real Olympics aficionado, a sports fan.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there was nobody better to dive into these films. And so we sent him this, you know, it's really, I think 6,200 minutes of films or something like that. It's a lot of movies to see if he was interested in, and he, in exploring further. And he immediately jumped at the task and wrote this really very, very interesting and useful kind of book that does start to elucidate some of those strands I'm talking about, whether they're historical strands or film historical strands, or even these ideas about how about the filmmaker's relationship to the subject. I mean, the Claude Lelouch film, you can feel that it's made at the height of the French New Wave, you know, and it's lovely that way. And it's also, those films have been influential on other films. You know, Downhill Racer, the skiing movie that Redford made,
the Michael Ritchie film. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Sure.
Well, they went to the 1968 Grenoble Olympics to watch those skiers there and to watch how the people who were shooting was shooting. And Jojé Jalbert, who I think was one of the ski consultants and ski photography consultants on Downhill Racer, made two Olympic films himself. But, you know, that idea of the way the camera goes down the hill when a skier is skiing, I mean, that terrifying speed, that intimacy that you get with the idea of just how challenging what they're doing is, you know, that is something that was driven by movies, not by TV. You know, and TV absorbed all of this stuff, but a lot of these cinematic gestures were really thought up by filmmakers.
And once again, we're out of time. Maybe it can be a little bit less than 10 years before you do the show again.
Well, listen, anytime.
Okay.
Anytime.
Well, you said that now. My guest, whose passion informs what the Criterion Collection is all about, and Filmstruck, which I will delve into myself at some point, is our old friend Peter Becker. It's always good to have you here. Please come back.
Thanks, Elvis. Please do.
Okay. Our recording engineer here at NPR New York is Neil Rouse. The show is mixed by Kat Yores, edited by Blake Veit. I'm feeling somehow Olympian. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.